Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us this morning. Back in 1994, there was a landslide victory by Republicans that led to the first GOP-controlled Congress in 40 years. These self-styled Republican reformers were led by Newt Gingrich, who was to become the Speaker of the House. And when he and the other Republicans took over, they made a number of promises, among them to reduce the size of government and to reform politics as usual in Washington, D.C. Now 10 years have passed, and the party is embroiled in a scandal. It has already brought down a majority leader, Tom DeLay, and many people think it's possible that scandal might even reach as far up as the White House. And the question is, what happened here? How did we go from a period where the party was in the hands of idealistic reformers to a point today where it seems that the party is touched and maybe even overshadowed by scandal? The big question here is, these Republicans who went to Washington promising to change things, did they in fact change Washington, or did Washington change them? That is the question that we'll take up here in this part of Focus 580, and we'll be talking with Matthew Continetti. He's a staff writer at the Weekly Standard. He's also contributed articles and reviews in other publications, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Los Angeles Times, and he makes his home in Washington, D.C. He's the author of a newly published book, which is titled The K Street Gang, The Rise and Fall of the Republican Machine. That's the subtitle. It's published by Doubleday. It is just out, so it certainly should be available in the bookstore if you want to read the book. Questions, of course, are also welcome. Questions, comments. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, as always, callers are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So whichever of those numbers works for you, you can give us a call and be a part of the conversation. Again, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana folks, but anybody listening around Illinois or Indiana. In fact, since we're on the internet, anybody listening in the United States can also use that number. That's 800-222-9455. Mr. Continetti, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. Just maybe for anyone who is not familiar with Washington, D.C., just as a brief explanation of the title, we should ask you to explain, what is K Street?
Well, K Street is the avenue in downtown Washington, D.C., just a few blocks from the White House, where lobbyists ply their trade, where most of the lobbyists in Washington have their offices. But, you know, the number of lobbyists has doubled over the past few years. And so now the lobbyists are not confined solely to K Street, but they make their living throughout the city and indeed in the Washington suburbs in Virginia and Maryland.
So that if one makes a reference to K Street in a commentary in a news story, really that's what you're talking about. We're talking about the heart of the lobbying industry, even though it's not strictly limited to K Street.
That's right. And it is an industry. It's a $2 billion a year industry, in fact. People who take money from special interests, corporations or other interests, to try to persuade members of Congress and other elected officials to do the corporations or other interests' bidding.
If you look at the number of registered lobbyists and you try to tag them to as best you can, and in some cases it's very obvious whether they're associated with the right side of the political spectrum or the left side of the political spectrum, how does that break down? And is it roughly equal numbers of, say, Republican, conservative lobbyists or people who lobby for those kinds of interests and Democratic, liberal ones?
Well, I write about this in the K Street Gang. You know, for many years, just because the Democrats controlled Congress for 40 years, the lobbying industry, the people trying to ply access to that Congress, was Democratic. But in the late 80s and early 90s, and of course once the Republicans took over Congress in 1994, there was an attempt to shift the culture of lobbying in a Republican direction. And this was called the K Street Project. And it, for the most part, it was successful because there are now more Republican lobbyists than there were before. And the lobbying industry contributes more to Republican candidates than it had before. But I think that there were also some ill effects, not only for American democracy, but for the Republican Party, mm-hmm. because it's too close, as I write in the K Street Gang, it's too close to the special interests.
And this effort, the K Street Project, this was something that was the brainchild of the former majority leader, Tom DeLay.
That's right. Tom DeLay was an important actor in creating the K Street Project, and another important actor and figure in my book was Grover Norquist, who is a Republican activist here in Washington, D.C.
Maybe we could talk a little bit about, ground this in a current story, something that people have certainly heard about. How well they understand it, I'm not so sure. But this would be by looking at the story of Jack Abramoff. And it's certainly people will, I think, understand that he was had been a very influential lobbyist, Republican lobbyist, who in the beginning of this year pleaded guilty to a number of counts of felony for fraud and corruption, and so brought an end to his career and careers of perhaps people associated with him, and we're not exactly sure how far this is going to stretch and who this is going to touch. So I think people at least know that much, but perhaps if you ask them, well, could you tell me what Jack Abramoff did exactly? I'm not sure how many people really would quite understand what it was he is alleged to have done, or what it was he in fact confessed to having done.
It's a very complicated story, and I hope I tell it well in the K Street Gang. That's one of the reasons I wrote the book, because there are so many aspects to this narrative. No one had really tied them all together, and that's what I try to do in the K Street Gang and make it accessible. And basically, Jack Abramoff pleaded guilty to five separate counts in two separate investigations. One investigation involved his fraudulent purchase of a casino cruise company run out of Fort Lauderdale in Miami, Florida. And he confessed there that he had deceived his lenders and the people from whom he was purchasing the company. He had deceived them about his finances. And then in Washington, D.C., he pled guilty to three counts related to or rather two counts related to an ongoing investigation into his lobbying practices. Basically, Jack Abramoff directed business to a partner of his, Michael Scanlon, who charged enormous sums of money. And then, without doing much work, he and Scanlon split the money 50-50. It was called a give me five, was what they called their scheme. And over several years, they took about $66 million that they split from several Indian tribes. So it's an enormous sums of money that are involved here.
Mm-hmm. And also one of the questions is they enriched themselves, committing crimes, enriching themselves. It didn't, however, seem that they did much for their clients.
No, they didn't. In fact, that's what got them into real trouble. And there was a lot of deception going on here all around. In the K Street Gang, I also write about Ralph Reed, the former director of the Christian Coalition, who helped Abramoff shut down Indian casinos, but he was taking the money from the Indian casinos paying Abramoff. Of course, Ralph Reed, who is now running for lieutenant governor in Georgia, he is an opponent of gambling, so it would look badly if it was shown that he was taking money from these casino interests. And so they passed the money through a variety of tax-exempt institutions and other nonprofits. And this has landed Reed in some trouble as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, we can talk a little bit more about this and should, and talk maybe a little bit more about Mr. Abramoff and what happened to him. I guess, though, a bottom line for a lot of people is this, and I'm sure that some people within the Republican Party have said, yes, what Abramoff did was wrong. He was a criminal. He should be punished. He should go to jail. He should have to pay back a lot of money, which looks like what he's going to do. But they would say, it's the proverbial solitary bad apple. It's not the way business is done generally in the Republican Party. It's not the way business is done in Washington, D.C. Yes, there's a bad guy. He was a bad guy, and there are bad guys everywhere. But this is not common. This is not representative of the way everybody works. Is it representative of the way that, well, not everybody, but many people work?
Abramoff is distinct in the level of profit he reaped from his lobbying practices. And that always made him distinct. And then, of course, he was distinct in the illegal activities that he pleaded guilty to in January. But as a lobbyist, he used typical lobbying techniques. He organized fundraisers for politicians. He invited them out to dinners. He took them on golf junkets. These are tools in any lobbyist's toolkit.
Hmm. You have to wonder what exactly happened to this guy, because his background would suggest that this was not the kind of guy who was going to grow up to be convicted of felonies and of corruption. He seemed at one time at least should have been listed among the true believers. What do you think happened to Jack Abramoff?
Well, I think he would still consider himself a true believer. And that's the thing that I write about in the K Street Gang. You know, for the true believers, for the ideologues, for the people who believe that everything they do is in pursuit of this righteous cause, it often blinds them, I think, to not only what they're doing, but also to whom they're dealing with. For Abramoff, I think, in particular, the two schemes that he pleaded guilty to, these two investigations, one in Miami and one in Washington, were related. And this is partially conjecture, but I talk about this in the K Street Gang, which is that once he expected this Sun Cruise casino line to reap him enormous sums of money, and yet within a few months, the deal was in a mitigated disaster, and he was in debt, and he didn't know what to do. So he needed to raise a lot of money very quickly. And that's when he came to Scanlon, who was a former press secretary of Tom DeLay's. And they concocted the scheme by which they would defraud the Indian tribes. So the two were related, and I think perhaps the latter scheme, the Gimme Five scheme, the one where they collected the $66 million, I think that was related to the Sun Cruise scheme, but also born out of desperation.
Let's talk a little bit about Tom DeLay, the former majority leader. Now, he has announced not long ago that he would be stepping down from his position in Congress, that he would not run again. And here is another example of a man who fell from quite a height. He was a very powerful member of Congress and now is in trouble, allegedly, for things that he may have done back in Texas, where he organized this unusual off-year redistricting that made it possible to add more Republicans to their delegation, which added to the number of Republicans in Congress and added to the Republican strength and made it also possible, helped the Republicans take over the Congress again, or at least the House. In what way is he part of this, or is that, in a sense, a separate sort of an issue?
Tom DeLay is known for having called Jack Abramoff one of his closest and dearest friends in Washington, D.C. Abramoff centered his activities and all of his power in Washington on DeLay's office and plying, perhaps DeLay, but certainly DeLay's staff members, including Scanlon, the former press secretary, who also pleaded guilty in relation to this investigation, and the deputy chief of staff, Tony Rudy, who also recently pleaded guilty in connection to the Abramoff case, wooing them. And, of course, they both went on to jobs with Abramoff. There's a third former staff member, Ed Buckham, former chief of staff to DeLay, who is also under investigation in connection with this. So DeLay is very caught up in it. You know, I talk about, in the K Street Gang, about how at times Abramoff and DeLay's offices were inseparable. You couldn't tell who was working for whom, actually.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Matthew Continetti. He's a staff writer at the Weekly Standard in Washington, D.C., and he is the author of a newly published book. It's titled The K Street Gang, The Rise and Fall of the Republican Machine. It is published by Doubleday. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Do you think now that this the kind of things that we're talking about here, Mr. Abramoff and his associates, and possibly the difficulty that Mr. DeLay finds himself in, has this really stained the entire Republican Party?
Well, I think more important when you talk about staining the Republican Party is the loss of ideals. You know, Republicans came to power in 1994 and then in 1995 when they officially took over, pledging to drain the swamp of public corruption in Washington, to ship power back to the states and to the people more broadly, and to limit government. Now, over 10 years later, we see that they're up to their necks in the muck, and the government continues to grow. So I think the Abramoff case is instructive because it forces conservatives to examine how well they have, or rather, how badly they have lived up to their ideals.
Yeah. Well, you yourself are a young and idealistic conservative, so that's obviously the thing that's motivating you, that you're concerned that that they have slipped away from that point in 1994 when they were motivated by idealism. They were motivated by the desire to change politics, to change the way things are done in Congress. Do you think is a central sort of argument that you're making that that's the kind of thing that is just inevitable? I mean, it does that go to the corrupting power of power, or could things have gone differently?
I think things could have gone differently. I write in the K Street Gang about a moment that occurred early on in the Republican Revolution when Tom DeLay invited all the chief lobbyists of industry into his offices in the Majority Whip fabulous suite in the Capitol. And he told them, "What do you want?" So he had lobbyists writing these bills early on. And I think that corrupted the conservative movement and certainly the Republican Party, because it showed that they're not there for any national purpose, but simply to satisfy the special interests and the individual purposes of various industry groups.
Hmm. Can you give an example of something where the maybe legislation was enacted that was in the interest of a person or a small group of people, or maybe an industry that somehow runs counter to the interests of the country, and perhaps also runs against the stated ideals of the Republican Party?
Well, I'll give you an example that's in the news today. I mean, take a look at this $700 million appropriation that the two Republican senators from Mississippi inserted into the budget. That would move a rail line that was undamaged from Hurricane Katrina, but it would move it and change its location. And this is the largest earmark, what we call them, earmarks, whenever legislators appropriate money for a specific project. This is the largest earmark in history. And these are Republicans doing it. You know, and the Republicans are supposed to be the party of limited government. They're supposed to say, no, that's a job left up to the states or perhaps even the companies involved. You can look at the energy bills. You can look at the transportation bills. You can even look at the prescription drug plan that was enacted in 2003 as it places where lobbyists and the Republicans walked hand in hand. You know, I think the real betrayal of the Republican Revolution occurred in 2003 when the Republican Congress passed the prescription drug entitlement, which was the largest expansion of government in 40 years. And so this is the Republican Party enacting this expansion of government, not the Democrats. Hmm. I think that should lead to some reexamination of what the party stands for.
Well, in that particular case, and maybe this is sort of a side issue, but I think that there were many Republican members of Congress who felt that they were misled, misinformed deliberately by the White House as to how this would work, and particularly how much this would cost. Do you think that, in fact, that the members of Congress, when they voted on this, knew what it was they were voting for?
Well, I think many of them did. I think political interests played an important part here because the Republicans wanted to inoculate themselves from Democratic charges, and so they had to go through pass this bill. I think some conservatives, including Newt Gingrich, believe that the bill contained some important elements, including the expanded health savings accounts and whatnot. But there was some deception. The administration scored, that is, they budgeted this or estimated how much it would cost in such a way to kind of disguise, hide the actual cost of the bill. And then, of course, Tom DeLay was accused of bullying and threatening and perhaps even bribing Congressman Nick Smith from Michigan. And there was an investigation into that, and they found that there were no bribes or anything like that. But it did not reflect favorably on DeLay's behavior.
Mm-hmm. That's one thing I'm a little bit surprised that more Republican members of Congress haven't spoken out about that. Now maybe it's just simply a matter of You never speak ill of a fellow member of your party or your president, although maybe as time goes along here, there'll be more Republicans willing to speak ill of the president. But as I said, I'm sort of surprised that more Republican members of Congress weren't more angry and more publicly angry about this.
Well, I write about this in the K Street Gang. You know, Tom DeLay was one of the most effective and feared legislators in American history. I mean, he will be remembered for a long, long time. And DeLay ran his caucus very effectively. People didn't want to speak out against him. Now that he's gone, you can see the effects. The Republican leadership in the House is rudderless and ineffective, and everyone is running every which way. So DeLay did play an important part, and people didn't want to speak out against him.
We have several callers here. Let's start talking with people who are listening. We'll go first to someone in Mattoon. This is on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Listening to the discussion, it seems to me that historically, that especially if a party was in power, had the White House, that there was a strong, you know, leadership from that position that kind of kept congressional members in line, or, you know, at least towing the line. And in hearing what's going on, I'm wondering if the fact that so much of this has shifted to Congress reflects a shift in the power and where the power actually lies within those two branches of government, or if it just shows, you know, a really ineffective leadership at the top for, you know, and nationally with both parties, to have individuals that gain so much power and, you know, do these kinds of things on their own, apparently.
Well, I think if anything, the fact that Republicans control both the White House and the Congress has made the situation worse. I actually think divided government plays an important part, because the way that the founders set up the United States through the Constitution is to pit every interest against each other. Mm-hmm. And even though there are points where we can see the president and the Congress fight, I think total control by the Republicans has led them to behave rashly, to not quite understand what the effects of their actions are and how the public may interpret them. And, of course, as we've seen, is that the public confidence in both the Congress and the president has plummeted with this total control.
Did you see the same sorts of things going on then when the Democrats were in control of both the White House and the Congress?
Well, since that happened, I think you did see certain scandals. I mean, scandals are endemic to politics, basically, and they're part of a democracy, and there's always some level of corruption going on. But the question is, you know, does it get out of hand or not? And, of course, all the crimes that I write about in the K Street Gang remain illegal, thankfully. So these types of behaviors will be punished once they're uncovered. But, of course, the Democrats have not had much control over the White House since the 1960s. Mm-hmm. And so you always had a divided government there with the Republicans and, of course, with the Carter exception. But look at the Carter administration, where there you had total control, and that was an incredible disaster for the country and for the Democrats.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Indiana. Another caller here, line number 1. Hello.
Hello. I have to say that one of the few conservative commentators I've yet to heard say anything that I disagree with, so he must be a very mellow fellow. Being in Washington, D.C., and can do that to me. Secondly, is there a flashpoint socially when this kind of, I mean, I presume here in Indiana it goes on all the time, but it's very low level and it's more good old boy kind of stuff. But in D.C., you seem to have your fingers on a lot of things, though I haven't read all the things I'm sure that you've read that come out of D.C., pamphlet-wise and things like that. This must be well-known, but what point does it reach before people say, well, we better start doing something? And I know we've reached it here, but I was wondering if we should have reached it somewhat earlier, what the signs are, if there are such things, or, you know, is this just an art, or are we approaching sort of a quasi-science on knowing who's doing what and why and where the money's flowing? Thanks.
I think the flashpoints are always elections. Elections determine the behavior of politicians more than anything else. And the Republicans, of course, when Abramoff pleaded guilty in January, the Republicans moved to cover their bases and pledged reform. But when you look at the bills they passed, the House and the Senate, they're rather ineffective. The Senate bill, I think, is more effective than the House bill, and the House bill is almost just partisan. They want to further regulate campaign contributions, specifically the 527 groups, which, of course, are Democratic. And so there's a simple partisan power grab there in the House bill. But elections determine behavior, and they shape policy. And so depending on the outcome of the election in November, I think you'll see changes, whether that's because the Democrats have taken over Congress or whether the Republicans have suffered a blow that perhaps wasn't fatal, we have yet to see. Also, in primary elections play an important part. I write about Ralph Reed, who, as I said, was running for lieutenant governor in Georgia. And he faces a challenger, a conservative Republican, who says that these ethics allegations and Reed's association with Abramoff will lead to a disaster for the Georgia Republican Party in the fall. All these issues are raised, I think, in the context of an election.
The response in the Congress, at least part of the response in the Congress to the whole Abramoff story, was to start talking about lobbying reform, to start talking about placing limits on what lobbyists could give to members and to try to do what they can to have more of a kind of paper trail, to have more openness about indeed who is giving what to whom. And I think that while people in Washington said, well, that was all well and good, that the deeper problem is the problem of money in politics. And to deal with that, what you've got to do is do something about campaign finance reform, which now I think members in Congress have been really hesitant to do anything really very substantial. That's the money in politics. A lot of people say that's the problem. Is there much? Do you think much sentiment in Washington to do anything very substantial about changing the ways that campaigns are financed?
Well, I'm not sure money in politics is the problem. There is always money in politics, and it's impossible to get it out. And, of course, the Supreme Court has a long history of ruling that money is a form of speech, and so you don't want to regulate too tightly political speech. Now, that said, we have a Byzantine campaign finance system that I actually think leads to more lobbyists and more power for lobbyists because of the caps on donations. Politicians spend all of their time raising money because they can't have one or two or three or four donors provide them with all the money. And so they need to spend time with lobbyists who play a role of setting up these fundraisers for them and bundling money. And, of course, much of Abramoff's power in Washington, as I write in the K Street Gang, was about his ability to raise enormous sums of money, not only for DeLay and company, but also for President Bush. So I think, actually, if we look at campaign finance reform, we need to look at either a complete public financing system or, alternatively, changing the nature and lifting the regulations so that we can kind of cut the demand for lobbyists. And thus, I think that will limit the supply.
Mm-hmm. Well, here, for example, here in the state of Illinois, there are no limits on campaign contributions. You can give as much as you want to anybody. The thing that's supposed to balance that is disclosure, which seems to work imperfectly if it does at all. Now, I know that some people on the national level think, well, maybe that would indeed be the way to go. Say, we'll just put all limits off. We'll say you can give as much money as you want to anybody as long as it's absolutely clear and out in the open who's giving and how much they're giving. Do you think that that actually would be a good strategy?
I think it's something to consider. And you know who's also considering it are Democrats, James Carville and Paul Begala in their new book. And I write about this in the K Street Gang. They talk about a system like you just mentioned. And I think that's an interesting idea. And in fact, many conservatives, when they read that in the book, they've asked me, you know, I can't believe that you're referencing Carville and Begala. But I think any, you know, it's a good idea is a good idea. It doesn't matter who it comes from.
We're a little bit past the midpoint here. Let me again introduce our guest, Matthew Continetti. He's a staff writer at the Weekly Standard. His articles and reviews have also appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the LA Times. And he is the author of a newly published book. It's entitled The K Street Gang. The subtitle is The Rise and Fall of the Republican Machine. Doubleday is the publisher. And the title, as we explained in the beginning, refers to the fact that K Street in Washington, D.C. is the street where many lobbyists have their offices. They're not all there, but a lot of them are there. So when you talk about K Street, that's the importance of the reference. Questions here, welcome. We have some others, 333-9455. We do also have toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800 1-800-222-9455. The next caller is in Urbana and line two. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Going back just a few years, Dennis Hastert became speaker on a, what I would say, a wild Saturday morning due to a double scandal in the Republican Party. And I thought that would be good for our state. But a congressional commentator on the NewsHour said that, in fact, it was her opinion, I forget her name, that Tom DeLay was actually pretty well running things for the Republicans in the House of Representatives. Do you agree with that? And has our local congressman, Tim Johnson's name, come up in any of your reporting and fact-finding? And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. It is interesting, the question of Hastert and how it is he became speaker. When looking at his background up to that point, you'd think this man was rather unlikely candidate for the Speaker of the House.
Hastert was always very popular with his colleagues and, in fact, enjoyed this idea that Tom DeLay was more powerful than he. And, of course, Tom DeLay was very powerful and effective. I don't think people fully understand the nature of Tom DeLay's power in Washington. You know, he has a reputation for being a very tough and aggressive politician, and certainly he was when he confronted his opponents. But many Republicans thought of him as a generally nice guy. So I think this power is a mystery, and I'm not sure who was more powerful. You know, certainly by titles, to be the Speaker of the House is the most important person in the House of Representatives. And, of course, Tom DeLay is going to leave Congress, and Dennis Hastert remains. So I think we'll now see how important DeLay was once he leaves, and whether that affects Hastert's power. Also, Tim Johnson has not come up. I'm sure he and you will be reassured to hear. He has not come up in my reporting and writing.
Well, this I'm still thinking about. Now, Hastert became Speaker after Newt Gingrich resigned. He had some personal problems, and then another member looked like he might well become Speaker, Bob Livingston, a member of Congress from Louisiana, but then he had some personal problems, and then suddenly then there were some others that, again, seemed like they had more of a power base. And it just seems a little surprising that somehow we ended up with Mr. Hastert as the Speaker, regard of his fellow members notwithstanding.
Right. Well, I mean, certainly in these types of leadership elections, the regard of the fellow members are the most important part because they're the ones who vote. Interestingly enough, you know, Tom DeLay and Michael Scanlon, his press secretary, played an important role in that election for the Speaker of the House, and also, of course, in the Clinton impeachment more generally. And I write about that in the K Street Gang.
Let's take another caller. This is someone here in Champaign County, where we are, line three. Hello.
Hi. Since Johnson's name was mentioned, there's no allegation this is illegal, but I think it's always curious to see who's giving the money, and he got $2,000 from Exelon, and it was very close in time to when the Federal Energy Agency gave Exelon $23 million matching grant to do the construction permit for the nuclear plant. Now, you can just say, well, they're a big employer in the area, and he's their congressman. But so I'm not alleging there's anything illegal, but a lot of what's unseemly in Washington is not the stuff that's illegal. But I wonder whether you cover Safafian. My platitude for the day is the rot starts at the head of the fish. Safafian was like second in line in procurement, which is what people are lobbying for. They're lobbying for these contracts. And he's there hasn't been a lot of reporting about it lately. I think the trial date is set. I'm sure they're going to try to punt it past the election because, as I say, he worked right out of the White House, and his case came up through some revelations having to do with the turning of Scanlon and the whole Abramoff crew. I don't know, do you mention him at all in your reporting? Or?
Of course. David Safavian is a key player in the K Street gang. David Safavian, who is the former director of federal procurement policy at the White House, in charge of about $300 billion annually in federal purchasing, was an apprentice of Jack Abramoff's and of Abramoff's close friend, an associate, Grover Norquist. In fact, he was a lobbyist alongside Abramoff in the 90s and then formed a lobbying company with Grover Norquist before he went to work on Capitol Hill and then at the White House. And now he is awaiting trial in regards to the Abramoff investigation because he allegedly lied to investigators about his involvement with Abramoff. And in fact, the prosecution, that trial begins on May 22nd. The prosecution has just recently filed many, many emails detailing the relationship between Abramoff and Safavian. And indeed, Safavian, even as he was running federal procurement policy, was angling for a job with Abramoff as a lobbyist. So that will be a very interesting trial to watch, and Safavian does play an important part in the K Street gang.
Assume discovery is going ahead, and these emails that you're talking about are one of the first products of that? Or?
That's right. The trial begins May 22nd.
Mm-hmm. I have another point, which, again, this goes back to the idea that the rot starts at the top. I have in front of me an Enron letter to then-Governor Bush from April 3rd, 1997, and it's curiously written. It's got Dear Governor Bush, and then it's crossed out Dear George, signed Sincerely Ken, but it starts out, the first paragraph has startled a lot of people. You will be meeting with Ambassador Sadiq Safaev, Uzbekistan Ambassador to the United States on April 8th, period. So this is the head of Enron just making a statement. You will be meeting with. It was revealed by this Craig Murray, the former UK minister, ambassador to Uzbekistan, who's very angry about all this, which is not, germane to this discussion particularly. And well, there is the idea that Enron was given a lot of corporate favors in the international realm by the Clinton administration before Bush. So I'm just saying that this stuff kind of goes back a ways. It's not dramatically different. Maybe it started in Texas first or something like that. But just the audacity of someone who is, the primary backer of Bush, just saying you will be meeting with, making his calendar for the then governor of Texas. It just strikes me that this too isn't illegal. It's just pretty arrogant, and I think the connection should be drawn to the money. This is like about a $2 billion contract with Gazprom and the Uzbekistan. It never went ahead, obviously, but. I just wanted to see how you would reflect on that. Thanks. And the idea that this is really goes into the White House.
Right. Well, I don't know about the context of that letter. Enron does make an appearance in the K Street gang because they hired Ralph Reed, the former director of the Christian Coalition, who is a figure that I write about in the book. And, in fact, they also gave money to Grover Norquist and others as part of their lobbying campaign here in Washington. In terms of the Abramoff scandal and its relationship to the Bush White House, I think for now Safavian is the key juncture. And also investigators are examining closely Abramoff's relationship with certain officials in the Interior Department. Abramoff's most prominent clients were Indian tribes operating casinos throughout the United States. And the Indian tribes depended on the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Interior Department for various regulations, because the Indian tribes, since they are sovereign entities, deal directly with the federal government. And so the investigators are looking closely at whether Abramoff engaged in any improper conduct with members of the Interior Department.
We are headed into our last 15 minutes here on Focus 580. Our guest is Matthew Continetti. He's a staff writer at the Weekly Standard, and his book is The K Street Gang, Rise and Fall of the Republican Machine, published by Doubleday. Questions are welcome. We have another person here ready to go. Others can certainly give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here's caller in Matt Toon, line one. Hello.
Hello. I think it would be wrong to jump to conclusions or try to make connections or try to draw conclusions from just a piece of paper and you know, who knows what the rest of the story says or what the rest of the paper says. The last caller, I think, is trying to make something out of nothing, and I think we're ignoring the fact that this happens on both sides, and there's just something with power and with money, and this is just inevitable.
In a way, it is inevitable. Like I said, corruption or simply money in politics is a constant feature of our democracy. And the question facing voters, I think, is how much impropriety are they going to take, and how much, what level of an ethical standard are they going to hold their elected officials accountable to? And that's why, as I said, elections play the most important part here. And of course, Tom DeLay, who was faced with many allegations, certainly on all levels of ethical impropriety, beat his primary opponent, who was relatively unknown. But they had the primary in March, and he swamped him. But of course, Tom DeLay said that he felt he was going to lose his race in a Republican district. That's a Republican district he ran and represented for many years. He thought he was probably going to lose against this guy, Nick Lamson, the Democrat. Now that he's out, it may be continue to be held by Republicans. So elections play the most important part here. But certainly with the emails play a huge role, not between Ken Lay and George Bush, because I don't know the context of that document, but the emails between Abramoff and his associates are a huge part of my book, The K Street Gang.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Other people who are listening are certainly welcome to call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, given the fact that the way the system is set up in Washington and in Springfield and every place else, incumbents have tremendous advantages. It's very difficult to unseat someone who has been in office for a while, has had the opportunity particularly to raise a lot of money. Incumbency certainly has its advantages. What do you think are and I think now that people are talking about the possibility that the Democratic Party might regain control of Congress now in the midterm elections. It seems like a kind of a long shot to me, but what do you think are the possibility that there would be, let's say, for the Democrats in Congress, significant gains?
Oh, I think there's every possibility of that. I think that if the election were held today, the Democrats would win both the Senate and the House. The only question is what will happen between today and Election Day in November. And of course, in politics, you never know what's going to happen. Issues emerge, candidates emerge just out of nowhere. Events dictate what the course of any campaign is going to be like. So we don't know what's going to happen in November, but I do think, just if you look at the polling, I mean, the regard for the President Bush and for the Republican Congress is at all-time lows, similar lows to what we were encountering in 1994 when the Republicans took over. There's no question that incumbents enjoy special protections. You know, Newt Gingrich, in fact, calls the current financing campaign financing system an incumbency protection racket because, as I said, the lobbyists play such an important role here. Where are the lobbyists? They're in Washington. Where are the incumbents? They're in Washington. And so that gives any challenger a disadvantage when they want to run and enter public life. So I think there, too, you need to look at how we finance our campaigns and how we can level the playing field between incumbents and challengers.
Hmm. It seems to be the case now that increasingly conservative Republican commentators are willing to publicly talk about the fact that they think that the Republican Revolution has lost its way, has lost its hold on the values that it started with, and that we have people as well regarded in conservative intellectual circles as someone like Francis Fukuyama, for example, very publicly critical of President Bush and his leadership and his decision to go to war with Iraq. I wonder what you make of that and whether and what it is that people like you and others would like to see happening within the party and in an ideological sort of sense, I guess.
Well, I'm not the K Street Gang isn't about the Iraq War, which I'm a supporter of. So but it's about the scandals in Congress. And I think what those scandals present to conservatives is a challenge, and they need to ask themselves whether their leadership or whether the Republican Party is the party of conservative principles. And I don't know if it is. The central conservative principle is limited government. And yet government has expanded under the Republicans to unprecedented heights. There is a lot of discontent with President Bush and the Congress. And that's because Bush is weak and because the Iraq War is not going very well. And so this brings out many criticisms. And like I say, we'll see some staff shakeups, and certainly we see that in the White House. But you probably won't see any shift in policy on both parts, the part of Congress and the part of the president, until after the November elections.
Well, do you think that that now Republicans are thinking that President Bush is not the man that they thought he was? Was it something about the circumstances that he's had to deal with during the time that he's been president? I guess I'm not really I wonder really what's going on there, whether you would think that he was not up to the challenge from the beginning, or that somehow the things that he's had to deal with are so difficult that maybe no one would have met that challenge very well.
With Bush, what you see is what you get. He's a conviction politician, and unfortunately his convictions now are alienating him for many, many people, including many Republican grassroots voters. And this is look at immigration policy, where Bush is a liberal. He wants enforcement, but he also wants to reform our immigration laws to allow voters, to allow even illegal immigrants a path to citizenship. And this alienates him from many Republicans. Look at the Iraq War, where Bush's convictions are that we need this to fight this to the finish, and that we need the United States needs to remain in Iraq until a government or some sort of democracy is able to take hold and secure the population, which will take a very, very long time. And this is scaring many Republican politicians and leading to a pretty acrimonious debate because American soldiers are in the middle. So I think with Bush, what you see is what you get. But many voters are discovering that they just don't like what they're getting.
All right. Well, let's talk with some other folks in the time that remains here. We'll try to get him in, get all of them in. Bloomington, Illinois is next, line 4. Hello.
Hi. I may be treading on dangerous ground here, but I have been struck as I've been listening to the scandals unfold that there has been not one woman implicated in any of these scandals. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that. Do you think it's just inherently the way that they tend to view power and leadership? Are they just not in the positions to be to influence people as much as the men have been? But I'm just very curious that there has been not one woman that I'm aware of implicated in any of these scandals. I'll go ahead and hang up and listen to your response.
Sure. Well, I do write about a few women in the K Street gang, and there are women involved in the Abramoff investigation. There is Talia Federici, for example, who ran a kind of a nonprofit, the Coalition of Republicans for Environmental Advocacy, that had many relationships with Abramoff and his associates, and that was being investigated by the Senate Indian Affairs Committee. There's a woman, Amy Riedenauer, who runs a think tank in Washington, D.C., which accepted Abramoff monies and funded or pretended to fund, that's being investigated, certain junkets that Abramoff financed. But you're right to point out that for this, for the most of the people that I write about in the K Street gang, it's an exclusively male group. And it's also a clique. I mean, I write about individuals who've known each other for over 20 years. They met in the College Republicans. In fact, they introduced each other to their wives in many cases. This is a very close clique of people that I write about in the book.
All right. Let's go to Normal. Next call. This is line 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
First, I admire your honesty for somebody working for the Weekly Standard. I'm sure I'm surprised you haven't been fired by now. But on the other hand, you've said one thing about the election, next election, how important it is, and how things change between now and then. And I was thinking that if the Democrats are smart, they will get on the issue that will not change between now and then, is that the Republicans have lost the right to call themselves conservative. They're social conservatives. They are not economic conservatives. And they ought to pound that fact home. I just heard the other day that Bush, with the compliance of this Republican Congress in the last 6 years, has borrowed more than the other 42 presidents combined. And so if that's one thing that cannot change between now and then. And I hope that they will pound that home. Thank you.
All right.
Well, you hit it on an important point there, which is it's Bush that's going to determine the election, people's opinions of Bush. I actually think that the Democrats don't need to really do anything to win this election in November. They just need to be the alternative. And I think they're managing things fairly well right now by highlighting what they say is the incompetence of the administration. I think that's a charge that the administration has not responded to effectively yet. But in the end of the day, when people go into the ballot box or the voting booth in November, they're going to ask themselves what they think of President Bush. And right now, not many, two-thirds of the public don't like him. So that's bad for Republicans.
We'll get one. Try to get one more caller here. This would be Champagne, line two. Hello.
Yeah, I guess I don't agree that this is inevitable. I think that's a kind of a cop-out. This phenomenon, whatever the bipartisan nature of corruption is, the Republican corruption has roots deep in what you mentioned, the sort of young Republican mentality of the 1980s, the rise of think tanks, the Richard Vigery kind of people. And people make choices. These are moral choices made by people like Jack Abramoff, who's an Orthodox Jew, and who puts what he does in the framework, you know, sort of cleanses himself, you know, from what he does all week by going to shul on Friday night. You know, so I think these are real. There's real moral issues here, and when you claim that corruption is inevitable, it basically says that we needn't explore what the context of these choices are.
We're at the point we got to stop. I got to get a quick thought here from the guest, if you have one, Mr. Condetti.
I sure do. I know. I mean, the caller is absolutely right that people make moral choices, and the K Street Gang is about moral choices that these people make. But that said, I don't think there's much we can do to prevent bad actors from entering politics and using their connections to their own personal advantage.
We'll have to stop there. The book is The K Street Gang, The Rise and Fall of the Republican Machine, published by Doubleday by our guest, Matthew Continetti. He's a staff writer at The Weekly Standard. Mr. Continetti, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.